There is reason to believe that the Air Force and other official agencies possess a great deal of photographic and even physical evidence attesting to the reality of extraterrestrial craft. 13. However, there is also reason to be wary that there has been no communication between these spacecraft and any governmental authorities. If the UFO occupants are involved in the long-term monitoring of many human specimens, and or experimenting with various genetic structures, there would be no reason for them to communicate directly with anyone, official one way or unofficially. In other words, the government might not know anything more about the UFO phenomenon than you or one, they would simply have better pictures. Consider what kind of announcement a president could make if this were the case. An apprehensive population is asked to turn on their television sets for an extremely important proclamation by the nation's commander, in chief. This is what they hear: "My fellow Americans, it is my duty to inform you of a nearly unbelievable fact. The Joint Chiefs of Staff and the CIA now possess incontrovertible evidence that extraterrestrial space vehicles are operating within our atmosphere. We have numerous films, close up photographs, and radar tracking reports of these objects. They can outfly any aircraft in our defensive arsenal. Their means of propulsion is at this moment completely unknown to modern science. There has been no communication between these alien craft and ourselves. We have no idea of their intentions, or whether or not they are peaceful. We will simply have to wait and see." If that is all an American president could say to the people, and it is my guess that this is precisely all he could say, it is fair to assume that near panic might ensue. Surely, most long-range planning would suffer. Who would save carefully for his children's education? Who would invest in any area requiring long-term economic stability? How would real estate and life insurance and other similar economic sectors fare under such an uncertain future? One can imagine that the policy of any government would be to withhold information about the UFO phenomenon until there is some official communication between extraterrestrials and ourselves. 3. When we consider the unfolding history of the UFO phenomenon in recent times, an interesting sequence presents itself. 14. In the 1896-97 wave of sightings alluded to in the introduction, the craft often were described as moving slowly, though more familiar UFO maneuvers and great bursts of speed were also reported, seemingly to observe our towns and cities from a low altitude. It was, of course, an infinitely simpler world in those far off days, and there was little anyone could do to interfere with these overflights. In almost all of the many contemporary newspaper accounts about these craft, they were assumed to be nothing more than the remarkable product of an earthly inventor, whose identity and the location of whose factory excited great curiosity. The second major UFO wave, as I pointed out, was during World War II, when hundreds of pilots on both sides found their warplanes accompanied by small discs, occasionally only a few feet in diameter and often only a few inches away from wingtip or cockpit. Relatively few overflights of cities were reported. The UFO's interest was apparently focused on our airborne achievements. Again, the reports show that most everyone assumed these speculations. Both E. H. Grimm and Hope Eiffel, so called foo fighters, were terrestrial secret weapons of some sort. Immediately after World War II, in 1946, a number of rocket-like craft were sighted over the Scandinavian countries. So sure was the Air Force that these UFOs were Russian secret weapons that General James Doolittle was dispatched to Sweden to investigate. 15. So it is a simple matter of historical fact that UFO sightings preceded by years any idea that they may be extraterrestrial spaceships. The widely disseminated theory that UFOs have been wished into existence by people in need of quasi-magical space people is untenable. There are cases, however, in which people have, after the fact, seized on the UFO phenomenon and adapted it for their own cultist purposes, in the same way certain primitive people have erected effigies of airplanes and made them objects of worship. The overflights of real craft in each case provided both the pretext and the symbol. The theory of an extraterrestrial origin for the UFO phenomenon only began to be formulated around 1947 after observers like General Doolittle and others found absolutely no evidence that UFOs were Russian, American, or some other nation's experimental hardware. The sequence of events I am theorizing follows a logical course to the present interest by UFO occupants in genetic experimentation and observation. Originally, at the end of the 19th century, our cities and towns were seemingly the objects of extraterrestrial surveillance. Infrequent UFO sightings continued to be made until the 40s, when earthly airborne technology apparently became the target of avid UFO curiosity. By 1947, extensive UFO flights over the United States and Europe were in progress, with particular attention being paid to military and atomic installations. 16 by 1950, as we have seen, the abduction phenomenon has begun. Whether or not this sequence of events will stand up to scrutiny as a systematic escalation of UFO curiosity is uncertain. The iceberg of unreported UFO cases may have a different shape than its documented tip so far indicates. 4. One of the many perplexing facets of the UFO abduction phenomenon is what seems to be an externally induced amnesia, forced, perhaps by post-hypnotic suggestion, upon the abductees. Several interrelated questions present themselves. How is the process accomplished? Why is it done? Especially if the UFO a coup, and so long as he remained that way, no post-hypnotic SU-98 estrogens could be implanted. And since Parker could remember the beginning of the abduction, there might have been no reason to be jock the recall of just one witness, Hickson's memory. Therefore, was left relatively unimpaired. The Pascagoula affair is a possible ex-MP, it would seem, of a semi-botched abduction. If the amnesia that follows an abduction has been induced when the individual is in a trance very like our own hypnosis, we should expect a wide variation in its effectiveness and longevity. The reader by now should have a strong sense of this range in the ease or difficulty various abductees have had in piercing their own amnesia, but an additional case I help demonstrate the problem. A woman friend of mine, whom I shall call Mary, is a painter with the kind of deep, seated and uneasy interest in the UFO phenomenon that often indicates a buried UFO experience. Mary is happily married, successful, and the mother of three children. In the summer of 1979, in my Wellfleet studio, I told a group of friends a little about the Virginia Horton and Philip Osborne cases. Mary was there, and her eyes were wide. A week later, she called me and said she wanted to drop in for a chat. She arrived looking nervous and uncertain. She said that she, as I had outlined there, two cases and described the unusual wounds and the lack of memory about their causes. A memory of her own came vivid why, speculations both grim and hopeful, back to her. She had been a little girl, playing in a neighbor's garden in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I don't know if there's anything to this, she said, using a phrase I have heard many times, but I had an experience a lot like Virginia Horton's. Mary had also been struck by a further coincidence. Like Virginia and Philip, she, too, was born in 1943, and the incident, again like theirs, happened in the summer of 1950. It was one of the strongest memories of her early childhood. As she was playing outside, she glimpsed a hummingbird, the most beautiful thing I had ever seen. It was absolutely gorgeous. I followed it around the garden as it went from flower to flower. I remember everything as being so vivid, the smells, the sunshine, the tall hollyhocks, and that beautiful hummingbird. Deciding to try to capture the hummingbird, she went into the house to get a glass jar to catch it with. She remembers later running back into the house holding the jar with her prize inside, and proudly raising it up for her friends to see, but the jar was empty. And, on top of this disappointment, she was scolded for something she cannot remember, perhaps for having been gone too long, and it was pointed out to her that her leg was bleeding. She felt no pain whatsoever, and assumed the blood had gotten on her leg from someone else. The shock when she found out that she had not, After all, caught the hummingbird was more profound to her than the sight of blood on her leg. She felt as though she had been somehow tricked, the hummingbird bad to have been in the jar. She was angry and hurt. And the experience remains vivid in both its beauty and its disappointment across the intervening 30 years. I asked if the cut on her leg had left a scar, and she said that it had not. Mary has striking red hair and the myriad summer freckles that often go with it. And, at this point in August, she also had a handsome suntan. "Would you mind," I inquired, "if I looked at the backs of your legs?" I turned on the overhead studio lights and knelt down. On the back of her left calf was a thin, straight, horizontal scar close to the location of Virginia's vertical scar. Mary's freckles and suntan made the scar quite faint. So I called my wife, who was once registered nurse, to examine the mark. "Yes," said April, "it's a straight, hairline scar all right." Mary looked at me, her eyes wider and rounder than I had ever seen them. "I never knew I had that scar," she said, "and you knew just where to look." This story is in a kind of investigative limbo. Mary has had 6 hypnotic sessions with Dr. Claymore, and through them all, she vividly remembers everything except what happened between her chasing the hummingbird and her arrival in the house with an empty jar and a bloody, painless incision on the back of her calf. She experiences the block as a wall that she can neither see through nor outflank. But there is a positive significance to this absence of recall. 30 years ago, something cut her leg neatly and deeply across a relatively inaccessible place, the back of her calf. The still visible scar and her memory make this virtually certain. If the wound had a prosaic cause, it would most likely have emerged by now. Mary has had several disturbing dreams which seem to link her experience even more closely to Virginia Horton's. In late September of 1980, she woke up from a frightening near nightmare which began benignly enough. She was looking at a decorative thing. The way you'd see a map on a wall. And I don't know where it was, but it seemed to go through transitions. First, it was essentially a piece of decoration to me, and when I looked more closely, I realized it was a map that related to the heavens, and then it seemed to be almost a window, and that I was actually looking out into space. Also, there was someone with me who was explaining this to me, but this person was sort of like a voice over my right shoulder. And not anyone that one saw in my dream. The thing was flat at first, like a chart, and then it was as if I was looking past it into the thing that it represented, or it sort of melted away and I could really see what he was talking about. And the other image was looking down on a group of figures approaching me. This seemed to foreshadow the thing with the chart, but I think probably it should have come before. The figures at middle dot approaching me had a weird light on them. There was something artificial about them, and the HGHT shining on them was not a light I'd ever seen before. The voice was telling me that they weren't regular people. That there was something very different about them, and that's when I got frightened and woke up. I know there was more to the dream, but I think I blocked it because I was quite frightened when I woke up. I asked Mary about the chart. "It started like a colored draw, SPF dot dot Culatio NSBO TH Grim and Hope Ethel, ing. It had, like, a black background with the stars and planets in reddish tones. There were white tones and green colors, too." The disembodied voice was so like Virginia's patient explainer, who spoke to her telepathically, that I asked Mary about the actual sound of the voice in her dream, and she gave the answer I expected. "I don't remember hearing it as an actual sound." I inquired about its effect. "Explanatory. Like a teacher, or a lecturer. The voice seemed like it was explaining things to me. Sometimes I didn't like what it was explaining, but it didn't seem malign. The voice was not at all threatening. In the specific details of the star map and the particular way she perceived the neutral, explaining, but soundless voice, Mary's dream parallels both Betty Hill's and Virginia Horton's experiences. Dr. Claymore has hypothesized that the mind generally releases only those traumatic memories it can safely handle, and at a pace which also is manageable. It seems to me that fissures are appearing in the wall of Mary's amnesia, and that soon she, and we, will know more about how she received her scar, and what else occurred on that summer day in 1950. I suspect that Mary's beautiful hummingbird eventually will undergo the same transformation as Virginia's soulful deer. If, as I have suggested, abductees have their memories blocked through a process not unlike our own method of post-hypnotic suggestion, 18, and their memories demonstrably can be unblocked by hypnosis, why do the UFO occupants bother to do it in the first place? And especially why, if they know the authorities have strong, perhaps absolute, physical evidence that extraterrestrials are operating in our atmosphere? Two related answers to these questions should be considered. First of all, there is the possibility that the abduction experience is blocked from conscious memory for the good of the abductee. Virginia Horton said that she felt the amnesia was for our protection just in general. I probably would have told my friends in school and they probably would have given me a hard time. A rather immense understatement. One has only to read the account of Hickson's and Parker's turmoil after their Pascagoula abduction to realize the advantages offered by not knowing, immediately afterwards, what has just transpired. In fact, in the years after their abduction, these two men have had unusually difficult experiences in their personal lives dealing with the mind-wrenching thing that happened to them. Knowing too much, too vividly, and too soon may actually strain to the breaking point the fabric of one's previously accepted worldview. Memory blocks may also have to do with the abductee's role as a human specimen unwittingly being studied over a period of years. If people are being picked up as children, implanted with monitoring devices, and abducted a second time after puberty, at the very least the first abduction would have to be concealed. If the study is truly long-range, the subjects would have to be kept in the dark about their role for many years, and a strongly effective block would have to be imposed. The theory that amnesia is used as a way simply to conceal the presence of UFOs from government investigators is not persuasive, it seems to me, when one considers the frank and open showing off UFOs have indulged in over the decades. But above everything, finally, there lurks the disturbing possibility that these enforced memory blocks may be extremely effective. The few hundred cases in which the amnesia has been pierced may ultimately represent only a tiny percentage of the actual number of abductees. The epidemic, I believe, may be almost entirely invisible. £1.0. What can be done? Our collective human ego is about to suffer the same profound dislocation it experienced centuries ago when Copernicus established that we were no longer the center of the universe. Having got used to the idea that the Earth is merely one of several planets circling the same star, we will soon have to adjust to the idea that we may not even be the most advanced intelligence operating within our own atmosphere. And we must now take certain steps to minimize the inevitable damage to our collective ego that will occur when the evidence of extraterrestrial visitation becomes overwhelming. First, I believe, we must try to make the invisible epidemic visible. We must try to take the measure of the UFO abduction phenomenon. How many people have actually been used, and for what purposes? A recent experience of mine provides a textbook example of how we must be alert for clues in attempting to learn more about the extent of UFO abductions. A casual conversation at a Whitney Museum opening led to my being told, second-hand, about a recent UFO sighting. The witness was a microbiologist at a New York City hospital, and his April 2, 1980. Sighting was a rather routine nighttime observation of an oval object with lights. The thing that caught my attention was my informant's feeling that the witness, a close personal friend, had been unusually disturbed by the event. The disparity between a powerful emotional reaction and its relatively negligible cause, a distant night sighting, is a sign that the case should be looked into. A buried traumatic episode can easily be the hidden fuel for such a reaction. At the time I heard of this incident, I was very near the end of my work on this book, so I was reluctant to investigate further. But since my thoughts were focused on the issue of just how widespread the abduction phenomenon might be, I decided after all to pursue the matter. I called the scientist, whom I shall refer to as Dr. Gase, and asked him about his sighting. Apparently, the UFO had never been closer than perhaps 500 or 600 feet, and circumspect questioning led me to believe that there was no time lapse involved. He told me that, when he stopped his car to look up, and saw that the UFO had also stopped, he became extremely frightened. So frightened, he said, that he was afraid he was going to die there. I asked about his subsequent memories and feelings. "I've dreamed about this thing coming over my house and trying to get me, or engulfing my house. The first 3 weeks, I was even getting up at 2 or 3 in the morning and looking out the window, making sure that everything was all right. And, when I walked the dog, I had the strangest feeling that I should seek cover, that I don't want to be seen from the air." So great was the sense of fear he transmitted to me that, a few days later, I interviewed 2 of his closest associates to find out if he was a particularly timorous, nervous man. Separately, they assured me that he was firmly self-reliant and controlled, a man of greater than normal fortitude. It was the unusually intense fear that he radiated about this one incident which had been so striking to both men in the first place. One phone drive Gase's wife, and her casual attitude toward the UFO sighting confirmed my feeling that there had been nothing more to the April incident than they consciously remembered. Therefore, I turned to the possibility that Dr. Gase had had an earlier encounter, and that this long, buried trauma had been reactivated by his recent sighting. "Have you ever had any other experience like this?" I asked, and his answer was immediate. "Yes, when I was a kid. It probably doesn't mean much, though." He was a teenager then, staying with relatives in a cabin near Wurtsboro, New York. While walking alone one night, heading towards Yankee Lake to view the spectacular night sky, he saw a glowing thing that seemed to hover in the forest. "That's A11I, what can be done? Remember, I felt that something would come over the trees, and grab me. I remembered that feeling when I saw that thing last April." It was significant that he had immediately connected the 2 incidents. I pressed him for more details. I couldn't make out much more than that it looked large, it looked low, and it was aglow when it went into the bushes. It was like you're expecting something to come out and surprise you. That's the feeling I had when I saw this thing. What it was, I don't know, but it stuck in my mind at that point. It was sort of light green, a soft green with maybe a little yellow in it. I had no time to study it. I don't know if it was there a long time or not. It went into the trees beyond my ability to see it, and I was waiting. I had the feeling that something was going to grab, apostrophe, me. That's why it stayed with me and .dlhidn/gh/mnr.snboo/ that for quite some time. His phrase "and I was waiting" is a curious one, but then every detail he related was suggestive of the abduction scenario. He had no specific recollections of any time problems, but the incident had happened years before, when he had been only about 16 years old. I phrased my next question with a sense of foreboding. I asked what year he was born. 1943, he answered. "What has that got to do with it?" I said something about various patterns, and then came out with it. "You don't remember any kind of unusual childhood injury or accident involving, say, a laceration or an unexplained time problem or—" His answer interrupted the question. "There is one thing that's always been a mystery. My mother even gave me a beating because I said I didn't know how I did it. It is a cut on my knee and I don't know how I did it. I was playing in the backyard and I don't remember gashing it, but I had a tremendous cut on my knee. And I have the scar to this day. The flesh was open to a fairly deep level," my family doctor said to me. "My God, you must have been playing hard. What did you tear yourself up on? Metal?" "No, I was just jumping," I said. That was the only thing I could think of that might have caused it. I realized after I jumped that there was a little bit of blood. I asked how old he was when this happened. Around 7, I'd say, because I was still in Brooklyn. When I inquired about the surroundings, he said that there was open land near his house, with a small woods nearby. The scar, he said, is peculiar. It's directly in the center of the knee, right above the patella, the knee cap. That's what's so peculiar. He told me that he has lots of scars, but I remember how I got every one. Except this one, and this is the one that's always puzzled me. You're welcome to see my scar. You're the first person who's ever wanted to see it. But it's in a peculiar spot. It's hard to imagine how I got it. Dr. Gase's final recollection was particularly interesting. There was an old table in the backyard and I was jumping from that, and it was almost as if the wound just burst open. I don't actually remember it bursting open, but that's what crossed my mind at the time. I told the doctor that's what happened. I didn't cut myself on anything, it just burst open. I never came in contact with metal. Ordinarily, I would have cried, but there was no pain. None. I never felt anything. I thought immediately of Virginia Horton's and Philip Osborne's descriptions of their deep, yet painless wounds. Philip recalled that he was cut open very cleanly, and something taken out, and then just put right back together. He does not remember bleeding as profusely as one might expect, judging by the depth of his wound. Virginia felt that her incision just closes up and stops bleeding. Gase, however, was jumping off a table, flexing his legs perhaps minutes after his incision had just been closed up. One can surmise that the UFO experimenters in 1950 had a healing technology that was not quite adequate for a hyperactive 7-year-old boy from Brooklyn. Dr. Gase is the fourth person I know who was born in 1943 and who suffered a mysterious wound, most likely in the summer of 1950, when he or she would have been about 7 years old. The parents of each have been consulted. They remember the fact of their child's accident, but not its cause. Dr. Gase's father vividly remembers carrying his son to the doctor's office since the cut was so deep. Interestingly, Dr. Gase's wound, the one that burst open, was the only one of the four requiring stitches. I met Dr. Gase in late September at his office in a New York hospital. He is a strong, vigorous, no-nonsense kind of man, holding a PhD degree and an important research position. I took the chair he offered and sat amidst the paraphernalia of his scientific projects. He stood up and delivered what was almost a harangue, "What can be done?" On the subject of why UFOs cannot be extraterrestrial in origin, it is impossible for spacecraft with living beings to cross such vast reaches of space, they would never look like us in any way, and so on. What he saw in New Jersey must have been some kind of American or Russian experimental craft. I have never seen a witness so obsessively bent on discounting the UFO phenomenon, nor have I ever seen a man so frightened of what he is sure can't possibly exist. I proposed a scientific experiment. It would involve his agreeing to undergo hypnosis on the origin of his scar and the sighting he made as a teenager. Prior to this, I would have written down what I thought would emerge from the process. My accounts would be sealed and handed to his research associates, to be opened after his third hypnotic session. If I could effectively describe what these two experiences of his entailed, there would be definite evidentiary benefits. He instantly declined my offer. He could never be hypnotized, he told me, because he hates ever to relinquish control. In fact, I could see that my proposition had deeply unnerved him. What if I found out something so upsetting that I might die? What if it caused a heart attack? His fear is a powerful adversary. During lunch, as he and his friends and I discussed the issue of hypnosis, the conversation veered to the subject of science fiction. I asked Dr. Gase his reaction to some of the recent sci-fi films. I'm probably the only person in New Jersey who still hasn't seen Star Wars, he answered. In fact, the television commercials for that new one, the sequel, are disturbing to me. I can't watch them. He had seen the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind and it, too, was upsetting. This might be the place to reassure a reader about one detail: Stephen, Philip Osborne, Virginia, Mac McMahon, and almost all of the abductees we have been examining had not seen that movie prior to the recall of their abduction experiences. Actually, the film, in its junk, jewelry vision of the UFOs themselves, its noisy, chaotic exorcist-type episodes, and smiling, baby-like humanoids provides a kind of control on witness accounts. Almost nothing within these pages resembles in any way the Hollywood version of the UFO phenomenon. The contrast is actually startling.